Today's Teisho is on case 12 in the Mumonkan, entitled Zuigan Calls His Master. Zuigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Then he would say, "Be wide awake," and answer, "Yes, sir." Henceforth, never be deceived by others. "No, I won't." Mumon's comment, old Zuigan buys and sells himself. He takes out a lot of god masks and devil's masks and put them on and plays with them. For what, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake, the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. If you imitate Zuigan, you will play the fox. Mumon's verse, clinging to the deluded way of consciousness, students of the way do not realize truth. The seed of birth and death through endless aeons, the fool calls it the true original self. I want to thank everybody for sitting so well this morning in the Zendo. I think that the morning sits are just this wonderful opportunity to be fully in the moment. When we get up in the morning, our minds are relatively unclouded. I don't know about you, but I have sometimes I have really weird dreams at Sesshin. Last night I had an incredibly weird dream that I won't narrate to you. It was something that would have made some kind of very weird movie, I think. And there were monsters and other things in it, so I don't know where that came from, but when I got up this morning after my monster dreams, strangely, I felt great. and I sat down on the cushion and I had a wonderful sit, you know. So I was thinking about halfway through, man, this is the life, you know. I really love it. Mm-hmm. Somebody else told me that he had a really wonderful sit this morning. It's just so precious. You know, sitting three periods in a row like that is hard on, it's hard on your legs, you know. At the end of that period, people sat so still. When you sit so still like that, you can really concentrate. Your mind is calm and still after sleep, and then you don't move. And, in one of the sutras it says that bodhisattvas must develop long enduring minds. And part of what that means is that you really have to be able to sit still for long periods of time. As soon as you activate your body, your mind starts being active too. There's this body-mind unity. And so when you settle the body down in this very stable state, and then you work on the breath, you know, the mind becomes incredibly still. To do advanced koan training, you really need to be able to enter deep samadhi. Please don't ever listen to anybody who says that's not true. I have actually read people saying, Zen people didn't really believe in samadhi. You know, you don't need to do that. And it's just a false, you know. You really need to be in the deepest samadhi to engage with your koan and engage with your obstacles. And the marvelous mind of enlightenment is there if we can just be still enough, you know. So anyway, everybody did an outstanding job this morning through those three sits. It's really, really wonderful to see. This koan is a wonderful koan, as a matter of fact, one of my favorite koans about Zuigan. When you read the koan, you might think it's weird at first, and then you might think that Zuigan is psychotic. Because, if you could spy on him, if you could... every once in a while I would spy on Genki Roshi. May I tell you that? He had a room in Kugeyan, where we used to do our morning sitting, which was up on a mountain in Seattle. It was beautiful. It was really amazing that there would be a hill like this in south of Seattle. And we used to drive there in John Sunston's old Volkswagen bus. And we would get there around 5 in the morning and do Zazen. And I guess we'd get there at 5:30 and we'd do Zazen until 7. And then we'd have breakfast and we'd go off to our jobs or off to school. It was very nice. And I was the attendant for Genki Roshi for a while, and sometimes I was over at his house on other occasions, and I would go come into the house, and I would go upstairs, and he'd be in his room, and he had a room that had tatami mats on the floor. It was just like something out of a Zen temple or out of 17th century Japan. And I'd peek through the door, and I'd see him in there, and he'd be working with his inks, you know, with his ink block and his calligraphy, or he'd be reading something, and I would just sort of peek in, and I was never surprised. You know, he was a very interesting person, and he was very creative, very loved poetry. So it was like looking through a time machine at like somebody from the 15th century. You know, he'd be in there in his robes, making calligraphy, doing something, marking a poem, you know, that kind of thing. And I would peek into his private room, and sometimes and I'd see him doing this or that. And sometimes I'd go downstairs into the basement where he had his pottery stuff, and I'd quietly come down, and I could see him working away. He used to work on his pottery even before we would come to sit. So he'd get up very early in the morning to throw pots. And when we would come into the Zendo, we could hear him coming up from the basement, and you could hear him washing his hands, and he'd come up and put on his robes and sit down, and then we'd do our morning Zazen. But imagine if you looked through the door at your teacher and you saw him talking to himself. And he said, you looked through the door and you saw this monk, and he said, Master, Master! And then, yes? What is it? You know, it's a little bit like Smeagol in Lord of the Rings, right? You know, the precious. You know, so this Zuigan is calling and answering himself, and how does it go? Old Zuigan, every day he's saying, Master, Master, and then yes, what is it? And he'd say, Be wide awake. Yes, sir. And then, you know, henceforth, never be deceived by others. No, I won't. You know, so he's getting instructions from the master. So this sounds crazy a little bit, but it's actually, believe it or not, a healthy mind at work. Rather than being a portrait of a psychosis or something, this is actually like a healthy mind from the Zen standpoint. Yesterday, I mentioned that Zen is a little bit like psychotherapy, you know. I think Zen and psychotherapy complement each other. I think they do rather different things. You know, the goal of psychotherapy is to produce somebody who is a fully developed individual self, you know, with all that implies. And the purpose of Zen training is to produce somebody who is capable of entering a state of selflessness and acting from that state. So they're rather different goals, but both of them are quite excellent in their own way, and they dovetail, I think, beautifully. Anyway, I was saying yesterday that in some ways Zen training is like therapy, because we get caught in our own mental loops. You know, we get caught. We so often on the cushion go through the same mental dramas again and again. And as you practice over the years, if you continue to practice, you'll begin to know your own mental dramas, you know. So, you know, some people sit down on the cushion and around day two, they begin to feel very lonely, you know, very lonely, very friendless. You know, these are people who might have a lot of friends, but, you know, on day two of Sesshin in the morning, you know, or late on day one, they might feel, you know, I'm all alone in the world, I have no friends, you know, nobody likes me, and so on. And, you know, the teacher can say, well, come on, you know, I just saw you with your friends yesterday. But it doesn't really, it's a mental pattern that's been laid down early in life. And it tends to be very enduring. You know, we reinforce it again and again. And so, you know, at a certain point in Sesshin, you can return to these mental habits that are very deeply ingrained, you know. So you know, we're sitting for 9 hours a day, very intensely focusing, and it becomes wearing, and people experience their vulnerabilities more directly than they normally do. Basically, on the first day of Sesshin or the second day, people can encounter their vulnerabilities, you know. Their vulnerabilities, let me put it that way. You know, on day two of Sesshin, you could suddenly feel bereft. You could feel like, oh, I'm all alone in the world, I have no friends, you know, nobody likes me. And, you know, that might be something that you felt when you were very little, you know, and that tended to get reinforced in various ways. And it's still there. It's like a default position that you go back to, you know. Some people feel like life has cheated them, you know. They feel like, you know, I just haven't gotten my just desserts. A number of years ago, there was a person who no longer sits with us, but this person had been done some kind of injury to his honor, actually, or to his self-respect. And he just couldn't let it go. You know, it would just be like every Sesshin, it was like, and, you know, this person would just start rehearsing this injury, you know, and you know, this terrible, terrible injury that was done to him, you know, that he was disgraced or dishonored by something somebody had done. And it would come back every time. And this is not unusual. This was like his default position, you know. Some people, it's anger. You know, there are people who, you know, they come to Sesshin, and at some point it's just like a fuse going. You know, like lighting a fuse. It's by day, you know, day two or something, they're just ready to explode with anger. You know, I've had people come into the Zendo and say things like, into the Dokusan room and say things like, "Do you hear that guy breathing?" You know, no. He's breathing. You can't hear that. It's like a train coming through, you know, and just furious, right? Well, again, and you know, these patterns tend to come back, you know. So, like next Sesshin, you know, it might not be somebody's breathing. It might be something else. Did you see? He's not rinsing the dishes right, you know. And it's like, you know, really, you know, and this is really the case, right? So people. At Sesshin, you know, can fall into these deeply ingrained patterns that just keep repeating over and over again in the course of the life. And normally, they're under the surface, you know. And at Sesshin, they can become very visible, not necessarily to the person who is experiencing them, but sometimes the teacher can see this is a familiar territory. Right, you know, and eventually Zen practitioners recognize their own familiar territory, you know. It's very difficult to get out of this because when we try to get out of it, we just tend to spin back into the same cycles, you know. First of all, it's very difficult to notice that you have these patterns, you know. And when you notice, you usually try to solve them using strategies that you have had, you have tried before, and that haven't worked very well, you know. So, So usually when we're trying to figure things out with the discriminating mind, all we're doing is repeating the same mental habits that cause us so much trouble in the first place. You know, you can't really step outside your discriminating mind very easily. You might be able to if you read a book and you get some new ideas. You know, sometimes self-help books actually help, you know, because you get some new ideas that you never would have thought on your own, and you can try to apply them. You know, it's very difficult for us to see our own patterns, and it's difficult to get out because we just keep doing the same thing that has kept us there all this time. So the discriminating mind is not especially helpful in this way, right? Because, I mean, if you're if you have some kind of tendency to be angry, if something in your early life, say you were abused in childhood, you know, you could have a lot of anger issues, you know, or you were humiliated in childhood, you could be carrying those around with you. But, you know, usually the discriminating mind can find a reason to be angry. You know, this used to happen to me. You know, when I was in graduate school, when I was under the most pressure, I would get angriest about politics, you know. So I can remember, like, having to take my doctoral exams, and I was just furious about the political system. I had a lot to be furious about, you know. But I latched onto this, and it would just be like, the more I would think about, I think it was President Reagan, you know, so I had a lot to be angry about, but the more I thought about Reagan, the more angrier I would get, you know, and I think a lot of this was really, I was just feeling very pressured by my exams and things like that. So, you know, we tend to do this, you know, anyway, and we can always find reasons to be angry. You know, you could say, you know, do you hear that guy's breathing? It's like a train coming through, or, you know, do you see the way he washes the dishes? You know, he's, you know, it's like, no, I didn't notice, you know. But, you know, you can find, the discriminating mind can find a reason to feel the way you're feeling already. You know, the discriminating mind kind of makes up excuses for what is already the mental habit. So, you know, when we go to a therapist, we find somebody who can step out, who's outside of our own heads, and who can offer sympathetic, trustworthy advice from a exterior standpoint. So, you know, you wouldn't be able to do it, but your therapist can say, you know, do you see what you're doing there? You know, and sometimes people say, resist, but sometimes people are happy to have an alternative perspective. Well, Zen works very much in the same way, only instead of having a therapist, we're learning how to use the unconscious mind. The unconscious mind. And when we're calling mu, one way to think about mu is that we're going to the door of the unconscious. We're going to the place at which consciousness literally stops. And it's like staring into a cave and waiting for something to come out of the cave. So, you know, calling mu, when you're doing mu practice and you're calling mu, you're really trying to activate the unconscious mind, to bring it into active, to activate the unconscious mind. And people who are calling mu, you know, generally do it with their discriminating mind. So you come into the Dokusan room and you call mu and you're trying to sound strong or you're trying to sound something, wise or something, and it's very contrived and it usually doesn't come off very well. Every once in a while people come into the Dokusan room and they've sort of given up on the possibility of answering the mu koan. And when they call mu, it's very spontaneous, and there's a high level of mu energy, we would say. A real energy, real spontaneity. And sometimes the teacher can pick up on that. And you realize this is deeper intelligence at work. This is a deeper mind at work. When I was doing the mu koan, for many years I was really blocked You know, I would come to Sesshin for Sesshin after Sesshin, and I couldn't answer the Mukoan. And I would come into the Dokusan room, and sometimes I just wouldn't go to Dokusan, which was not a good idea. But when I would go to Dokusan, I'd always just say to Genki Roshi, I don't have anything to say. I'm not ready yet. And even though people were calling Mu in the Dokusan room, it never occurred to me that that's something I should do. So I didn't really know what to do with the Mu koan. I just sat there for years going, Mu, 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 Mu. And then I remember we had a sesshin at our temple. We were building our wonderful temple, Tokuganji, in the mountains north of Clay Ellum in Washington State. And that is really beautiful country, the Okanagan Mountains. And we were building this temple, and I remember it was spring, but up there at that altitude, it's pretty cold. And we had built a zendo, and we were all staying in tents on the mountainside. And I got up, and we had zazen before breakfast, and we were doing Dokusan before breakfast. We were holding Dokusan in the kitchen, which was a building detached from the Zen Hall. And I went into Dokusan, and I didn't expect anything, and I opened my mouth, and it was just this amazing Mu came out. And I just thought, you know, at the time I was just sort of stunned, really. And Genki Roshi laughed, and he said, well, that was a good Mu, you know. And where did that come from? You know, sometimes we can tap into the unconscious mind. And so calling Mu is something you can't really make happen. You just have to keep calling and just make your mind blank. And sooner or later, the unconscious is going to be actively present. The unconscious is going to call Mu instead of you. And this is really quite important moment in your practice. You know, people don't really necessarily trust the unconscious mind. You know, it's really a tremendously skillful and powerful mind. You know, I've talked about this before. You know, sometimes people who have traumatic experiences develop over time various kinds of dysfunctions. You know, so some people have had traumas and they sort of put them out of they hide them from themselves. And at some point they can suffer depression or other kinds of neurotic problems. And you could say, gee, my unconscious mind really has screwed me over, you know. But actually, if you think about it, your unconscious mind was very carefully protecting you. Even depression is a sign that the mind is taking care of you. I was reading this article about how depression in earlier human life served a purpose. That people, some anthropologists said it really had a very definite survival value. So that when people would be in very adverse circumstances, they would sort of shut down and become minimally active, and they'd just be sort of in this mode of shutdown. And they said this is actually a very good strategy in certain conditions. So my feeling is that you know, basically we have this wonderful unconscious mind, and it has extraordinary power. Every once in a while in life, it's activated very dramatically, and people feel so alive when this happens. You know, sometimes. Sometimes it happens when you're doing something like you're out in nature. It can happen in many different places, but there's sometimes the unconscious mind and the conscious mind match up, and there's just this tremendous sense of elation or being alive. And these moments are sometimes rare for human beings, but when they happen, they're tremendously, A good sit is an example of a moment when the two halves match up. When the conscious and the unconscious mind are working in harmony, there's this tremendous sense of being alive, of being the joy of being alive, you know. And you know, sometimes the unconscious mind can do really dramatic things. So, you know, you'll read all the time, there are these stories of people who, you know, somebody's trapped under an automobile and somebody leans over or somebody else leans over and lifts the car off the person, and you think, how was that possible? But there's this bigger mind we have, which is really quite astonishing. And so, you know, when we're stuck in our loops, we can call on the unconscious mind to show us a way out of our loops. You know, the unconscious mind is very creative. It can show us things that the conscious mind can't really think about, can't really come up with. Many times in my life, I've been stuck, you know, myself in like a either or double bind. I don't know if you know what a double bind is, but sometimes in life we're in a situation where no matter what choice we make, we're going to it's going to be unsatisfactory. And so if you choose A, it entails these problems, and if you choose B, it entails these problems. And so it's possible to go from A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, you know. This is a divided mind. This is from the Zen standpoint, the human condition actually is a divided mind. Eventually that kind of divided mind is very, very debilitating for people. You know, because you're unable to act in a normal, healthy way. You're always second-guessing yourself and putting the brakes on yourself. And instead of doing what comes naturally, what feels appropriate and liberating. And so divided mind is, from the Zen standpoint, is our number one problem as human beings. We all have a divided mind. This can produce a very unhappy person, you know. So that everything we're doing is wrong. Everything, no matter what we do, we should be doing something else, right? That feeling of being in the wrong place at the wrong time and so on. Or just a pervasive self-doubt, you know, which is extraordinarily common. I mean, most humans wrestle with self-doubt. I was watching, I came home one night after sitting, and my wife was watching something on TV. It was some movie, and I actually thought it was sort of an interesting movie. But at one point, our hero was talking to this older man who was like a rich guy. And he had a beautiful home, and he was showing, I can't remember what the movie was, but, it was actually a very interesting movie, now I remember it. It was about a woman who is basically a chambermaid in a hotel in France. And she becomes interested in chess. It's actually a great movie. She becomes interested in chess. She sees some people playing chess when she's cleaning up their room at the hotel. And she and her husband are both, you know, working people, and they have a difficult life. You know, it's hard for them to pay their bills. The husband might lose his job at the shipyard, that kind of thing. And she's working in this hotel, and they have a very, you know, it's a decent enough life, but it's there's nothing, you know, it's kind of a spare life. And she's cleaning up these rooms at the hotel, and there's two people, a couple staying in the room, and they're playing chess. And she can't take her eyes off the chessboard. It just grips her. And she starts learning chess and becomes incredibly engaged in chess. And she actually meets this man who is dying of cancer. And he is one of the people she works for. He's this rich dude who lives out in a villa in France. And he's dying of cancer, and he starts teaching her chess, and he's really good at chess, and he's amazed at how good she is. That she just, she's doing some, this is coming out of her deep unconscious, yeah? That this desire to play chess. And she, of course, it's consuming. It creates a lot of problems because, of course, you know, her husband's feeling neglected, her daughter's feeling neglected, she's obsessed with chess, you know. Her husband finally throws her chessboard in the trash. This sounds, you know, this is, if you've been married, you know these scenes are so familiar, right? You know, it's like, he, you know, and then he's sorry, digs it out of the trash, and, you know, he says, it's okay, you can play chess, you know. And, but, his, you know, it destroys their old family life, and there's a new family dynamic. It's like the husband, the wife, and her passion now, chess, you know, so... So anyway, it's a beautiful movie because, you know, at various moments she gets beaten down and she almost quits playing chess, right? At one point she just stops. And her husband can see she's so, it's like the wind is knocked out of her sails. This was her true nature. And now she's just stumping around, you know, sort of emptily going through the motions of life. And her husband has a lot of compassion for her and says, look, you know, please, look, here's your chessboard back. Please play chess. You know, I love you. I want you to do this. And so she starts playing chess again. And of course, the guy who's dying, the rich guy, has all these contacts in the chess world, and he gets her into a tournament. Basically, the person who admits her to the tournament is a chess snob, and he's French. You know, I love the French, but they're very snobby sometimes, you know, in their own way. And this guy's a classical French snob. You know, he's very class conscious, and he's a little bit appalled that this cleaning woman is here playing chess. And of course, the movie does have this element where they're interested in the class and gender issues. And of course, she's admitted to the tournament, and she just kicks everybody's ass. And the last ass she kicks is the snobs, right? You know, and he has this smug look on his face when he sits down to play her. But at the end, she beats him. You know, it's like, ah, great, it's so satisfying. You know. And then she's getting on the movie ends. She's getting on a ferry, and she's going over to play in Paris, play in the big leagues, you know. I loved this. I forgot about this movie until now, but my big mind just reminded me of it at the minute, in the nick of time, right? So you know, it's so perfect for this Tay show because. She trusted her big mind, and it came out of her unconscious, and she listened to it, and she encountered opposition, but she stayed with it, and this is so much the Zen. Naturally, after seeing the movie, I drove my wife crazy by saying, "Oh, this is so Zen!" You know, it's like, but it was. It's so Zen. You know. So, basically, we never really know what we're doing in life if we're really alive. If you had asked that cleaning woman, what are you doing? You're a cleaning woman. You know, go clean. That's your job. Why are you playing chess? And people did say that to her. They said, why are you doing this, you know? And she kind of said at one point, I can't not do it. You know, I'm in the grip of this, you know. And she was, we would say in Zen, she was true to her true nature. But, you know, all along that path, she probably was thinking, what am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. And that's why it was liberating. If she could have given reasons for what she was doing, she probably wouldn't have done that, right? Because, you know, the reasons we give are just going to be the old familiar assumptions. that got us into trouble in the first place, or that limited us in the first place. So you know, Zen people don't have a therapist who lives in an office somewhere. They have a therapist inside, you know, basically. Your true nature is a really marvelous therapist. And it's helping you all the time. But when it's helping you, you will feel that you don't know what you're doing. When you don't know what you're doing, it's possible for something good to happen, something new. When you know what you're doing, nothing new can happen. See? So on the cushion, if people come into the Dokusan room and say, I have no idea what I'm doing, I'm so happy. You know, it's like perfect, perfect. When you know what you're doing, you're just repeating. Yeah. So, you know, this spontaneous mind of enlightenment is really quite marvelous and much more creative, I think, than the discriminating mind. And so a lot of Zen practice is just learning how to access and trust this mind. Now, there's an element of this that's a little strange, another element to this that's a little strange. The discriminating mind is the mind of separation, judgment, and evaluation. And so, you know, in some ways, the discriminating mind is always an unhappy mind. Not always, but often. You know, sometimes I'm writing something and it doesn't make any sense to me and I'm suffering, but I'm also happy. You know, it's like, I'm not sure where this is going, but I'm enjoying thinking through an issue. And I'm unhappy, but I'm happy. It's like I'm hurting, but I'm happy. You know. So that's the discriminating mind at its best, right? It's sort of putting you through your paces and it... something is going to come out of this, right? But sometimes I'm unhappy, you know, it's because I'm listening to my discriminating mind. And so the discriminating mind says something like this, you know, I sent off an article to a journal and it got rejected. And, you know, it gets rejected and then you do your usual loops, right? You know, the article comes back, it's been rejected, and you think, I'm no good. I've known it for years. You know, or you think, I'm losing my touch. Or you think, you know, this must be politically motivated. Or, you know, so you have all these reasons to be unhappy. And you take this around with you. So when you go to work, somebody might say, have you done that report yet? And you're still thinking, I'm losing my touch. You say, what do you mean? You know, I'll get it done. You know, so this is like unhappy mind. And you could then you lie awake at night on your bed and you think, oh my God, that got turned down. What's going to happen to me? You know, maybe I'll never publish another word. You know, oh my God, people will laugh at me. They'll think I'm no good. You know, okay, that's a small mind sometimes. Now the big mind is the mind of unity. See, the big mind is the mind of unity. And so when the big mind When you ask the big mind how it's going, the big mind always says, great, excellent. See, excellent. See, the big mind always says good. The big mind always says no problem here. See? And so, you know, basically, when you sit down on the cushion and you think, oh my God, my article got rejected. I am a failure. Blah, 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 blah. And then you sit down and you go into your big mind. The big mind says what? It says, don't worry, be happy. Right? Okay. And, you know, sometimes you can say to yourself, well, what good is that? You know, what good is that? The big mind is an idiot, right? Right? The big mind is an idiot. Doesn't it see? Yeah. Does this make sense? The big mind is an idiot. Doesn't it see? It does. It's terribly important. But you know, actually, it's not terribly important. This is the truth. You know, we learn how to be worried about things that really aren't important. this is part of our socialization, right? So, you know, let's say your article doesn't get accepted. Or let's say you audition for something and you don't get the part. Or, you know, you cut a disc and you think it's going to be really something and it doesn't go anywhere, you know. And you can worry and worry and worry and worry. And then, you know, then you decide, okay, I've got to take a vacation. And you go on vacation, you go to someplace totally new. You know, maybe you go to Thailand and you're staying in a hut in Thailand, you know. And then you think back on your article and you say, who cares? You know, I'm just here sitting, looking at the ocean. Who cares about that stupid article? See, it's only a game. It's a game that we learn to play. We learn to play these games and take them totally seriously, like they're life or death. But, you know, sometimes we get out of our loops and we realize, one article, big deal. You know, and you know, what if I never publish another word? You know, I'll do my best, but if that happens, I'll find something else to do with my time. You know, that I can be useful in other ways, maybe. See, I mean, that's a mature perspective. And the big mind knows that all along. It's telling you, don't worry, it's okay. You know, it's okay. The great Zen master Shuyun, who was the greatest Zen master in the last 500 years probably, used to talk all the time about how the emperor of China, Henry Puhua, I think was his name, Puyi. Henry Puyi was the emperor, the last emperor of China, about whom Bertolucci made that very interesting movie, The Last Emperor. And he, when he was a little boy, he was in the imperial palace, and every day the cooks would bring in a huge amount of food for him. And he would lift a bowl up and look and say, not today. You know, and then he'd go to another, no. You know, and then, sorry. And then he'd find, oh, that's all right, I'll have a little of this. And, you know, it was just like this endless food was prepared for him, and he'd go picking through the dishes. At some point, there was a revolution in China, and suddenly he was deposed and running for his life. And this is true. And he was running through his life for his life, and he was not wearing his imperial robes anymore. He was dressed like an ordinary person, and loyalists were putting him up in their homes or in their, you know, hiding him in their barns. And suddenly he was sleeping on straw, and he was eating things like sweet potato shoots, which are pig food in China. Shuyun said, you know, one night he had spent the whole day fleeing across the countryside, and he stayed with these farmers, and they fed him a bowl of sweet potato creepers, they're called. And he thought, this is delicious. What is this? It's pig food. Wow, I love pig food. See, I mean, that's how humans create these structures that are a game, right? And we take them deathly seriously, and we torture ourselves, and we clog our arteries, right? And yet, you know, sometimes when we step out, we realize, what possessed me to be so concerned about this? You know, well, the big mind is like that. It says, look at this. Get outside of that loop. Look at it this way. And we're almost afraid to do that. We're almost afraid. It's like if I start being truthful in that way, where will it end? You know, it's like the whole fabric of my life will fall apart. It's like if I admit that this is a fiction, where, you know, it's like if I admit that the fact that I didn't get my promotion is not that big of a deal to me, I'm afraid I'll quit my job and go live in Hawaii on the beach, you know. So there's that fear, right, that anxiety. If I admit this is a game, what else will not be a game? So, you know, that's something you have to contend with. But usually, when you release that pressure on yourself, you're happier. You're more creative. Lots of things we take seriously don't matter, especially. And when we approach it as a like a game, instead of something that's deadly serious, we can be more creative, more spontaneous, more alive. So you know, when the big mind says it's okay, every time you go to the big mind, it says, you know, Zuigan says, "Oh my God, I didn't get that promotion, Master." And the Master says, "What a beautiful day. How wonderful it is to be alive." You know, Zuigan could say, "You idiot! You know, what help is that? What good is that?" But of course, that's the only thing that could be liberating, right? So you know, Zuigan comes and says, "My article got rejected," and the big mind says, "You know, what a lovely thing it is to be alive." You know, and Zuigan says, "I didn't get the promotion." Zuigan says, "You know, what a beautiful day, what a beautiful morning. Do you hear the birds, you know? How does it feel to have a body?" You know, to be, one more thing, I'll wrap it up, but there's this Chinese artist I just love, whose name escapes me right now. But he made his reputation by covering his body with meat. He was making fun of American culture. You know, Americans have an obsession with, like, bulking up their muscles, you know. And so he made a body suit out of pieces of beef, and he gave himself giant shoulders and a giant pecs and everything, and he was walking around with this meat suit on. He does a lot of interesting stuff. And I love his work, but one of the things he did was he had himself, he's also like a performance artist, you know, and he had himself closed up in this box that was supposed to open, and he was, from inside, and he was testing it in his studio, and he got inside and he pulled the doors closed and it wouldn't open. And he was, you know, it was like being in a coffin, right? And he said he was panic-stricken, right? It was just like, holy shit, you know? And he was screaming, and nobody came, right? And finally, somebody walked by and opened it up, you know? And he got out, and he said, it was the most, he said, "I suddenly realized how wonderful it is to be alive." You know, he said, "When you're dead, you're going to be like that," right? And he said, "But I got up and I moved my body and I thought, oh my God, how wonderful not to be dead yet." You know? So, how wonderful not to be dead yet, yes? That's a lot of what Zen is all about, right? You know, is getting back in touch with that elemental life energy. Zuigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Little mind and big mind working together, see. Then he would say, "Be wide awake," and answer, "Yes, sir." "Henceforth, never be deceived by others." "No, I won't." Mumon's comment, "Old Zuigan buys and sells himself. He takes out a lot of good God masks and devil's masks and puts them on and plays with them. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake, the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any one of them, you will be a failure." See, nobody wants to be a failure. So he's, Mumon is needling you a little bit. Say, go deeper in your practice. "If you imitate Zuigan, you will play the fox." Mumon's verse, "Clinging to the delayed, deluded way of consciousness, students of the way do not realize truth. The seed of birth and death through endless aeons. The fool calls it the true original self."